I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, why does the cocaine mecca of Colombia receive more U.S. aid than any other country in Latin America? But first, Russian President Vladimir Putin once again tells President Bush, not in my backyard, when it comes to a proposed U.S. missile defense system in Eastern Europe. But this time, Putin offers a surprise alternative. Putin told Bush today that he would drop his objections to the defense system if the United States sets it up in Azerbaijan, right on Iran's doorstep, and 1,200 miles from Moscow. The two leaders met at a G8 summit in Germany today. For more on that and a possible deal on cutting greenhouse gases, we go to Newsweek senior White House correspondent Richard Wolff, who's on a shaky cell phone from a Baltic Sea resort. But the summit is being held in that resort. But Richard, I understand you're hanging out in a wheat field. What are you doing there?
Well, I'm just outside the security fence, which is separating the leaders of the world's largest industrial countries from several thousand protesters, anarchists, pacifists, and just about everything else, I think. And there's a line of police here, riot police, 16,000 police in all, protecting the leaders. And they are having something of a standoff in the sunshine right now.
How many do you think there are out there from previous? Is it more than previous G8 conferences?
Well, the police estimate something like 100,000 protesters in total in the area. That's a lot less than there were at Glen Eagles in Scotland a couple of years ago. There were 200,000 there, but a lot more than there were in St. Petersburg last year, where the Russians managed to keep it down to just 10,000.
Richard, this meeting between Bush and Putin has been highly anticipated for weeks. Putin had said that if the U.S. goes forward with a missile defense system based in Eastern Europe, then Russia would target Europe with nuclear missiles. So how is Putin's new proposal being received?
Well, it was a surprise for a start. Putin has proposed that these missile interceptor sites go into Azerbaijan in Central Asia. You know, both countries, both leaders have been focused on the same threat here, which is essentially an Iranian nuclear missile. The Russians don't want it. Obviously, the Americans don't want it. But what the Russians are saying is Azerbaijan, Central Asia, would be a site to intercept and protect all of Europe, not just part of it. The president's national security team says they want the experts to go and take a look at it.
It seems on the face of it to be less provocative to Russia.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, there's no real reason why it should be provocative. There's a strong feeling inside the White House that this is really an internal political play for President Putin.
It sounds as if they're harvesting wheat in that field.
I think the anarchists have woken up from their slumber and are getting ready.
Meanwhile, one of the main issues of the G8 is greenhouse gases and global warming. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has made it one of her main issues, calling for the group of eight to cut emissions by half by 2050. There's a statement just released saying, in setting a global goal for emissions reductions in the process we have agreed today involving all major emitters, we will consider seriously the decisions made by the European Union, Canada, and Japan, which include at least a halving of global emissions by 2050. What's that mean, Richard?
Well, you have to be careful with the wording of the agreement. Serious consideration of a target is not the same as a real commitment. What it means is that the German organizers, especially Chancellor Angela Merkel, have put a lot of effort into coming up with a real target. President Bush has said no targets. He's not going to sign up for anything until he sets up his own system of talks at some point over the next year or so. It sounds to me like a face-saving piece of paper.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, talking to us from a wheat field near the Baltic Sea resort of Haile Gundam. Thanks, Richard. In the mid-1980s, Medellin, Colombia, was known as the murder capital of the world. When drug lords paid cocaine-addicted teenagers $750 for every police officer they murdered. These days, Medellin has a murder rate that's lower than Baltimore's and Washington, D.C.'s. Colombian President Alvaro Uribe will point to lower murder rates as a sign of progress as he meets today with congressional Democrats. He's lobbying for passage of a free trade agreement and no cuts in U.S. aid. But the economic powerhouse of coffee, oil, flowers, and textiles is also the coca garden of the world, a garden that's flowering, along with Latin America's oldest guerrilla war. Worse yet, President Uribe has been linked to paramilitary death squads, which are thought to have targeted union workers. And in his country is reeling from news about a baby born in captivity to a prominent politician held hostage by guerrillas for the last 5 years. Joining us on the line from Washington is Adam Isaacson, who runs the Colombia program at the foreign policy watchdog group, the Center for International Policy. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
You visit Colombia every few months. Are things getting better there? And from what you've seen, can President Uribe legitimately point to progress?
There's been some progress on the security front, especially in the towns, the large towns and the cities along the main roads of the country. You are less likely to be killed or kidnapped. And, of course, that makes a huge difference in a country that is about 70% urban. The majority of the people in Colombia do feel safer. And Uribe did that really on his own by taking the security forces, the military and the police, who really had a tradition of hunkering down on their bases and getting them out on the streets and getting them out along the main roads. There was a time about 5 or 6 years ago where you could not really even drive between Medellin and Bogota, about a five-hour drive, without risking being kidnapped by a guerrilla roadblock, and that's not the case anymore.
Why is Colombia so important to the United States?
Well, Colombia is the third most populous country in Latin America after Brazil and Mexico. It's got coasts on two oceans. It has oil. It's usually in the top 15 or so sources of imported U.S. oil, and there's probably a lot of reserves that haven't been explored yet. It is the source of about 80 or 90% of the cocaine that's consumed in the United States gets either grown there or processed there. And, well, let's face it, you've got a government there that has been relatively pro-U.S., whereas their neighbors in places like Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia have been much more critical.
How much of that U.S. aid involves getting rid of the cocaine supply?
Most of it. Colombia gets about $750 million a year right now, which makes it by far the number one U.S. aid recipient outside the Middle East. Of that, I would estimate at least three-quarters is aimed, in, maybe even more, is aimed in some way at the drug trade, whether it is money for interdicting the flow of drugs, for spraying the crops with herbicides, smaller programs to help peasants learn to grow other crops.
Is there any evidence? We see lots of evidence that that effort isn't working to kill the cocaine trade.
Just about every measure that you have indicates that we haven't had any impact. The street price of cocaine on U.S. streets has actually fallen in the years since Plan Colombia began in 2000. It's cheaper and it's purer, which indicates that supply is meeting demand better than it ever has. And even in Colombia, the acreage, the amount of land planted with coca, the plant used to make cocaine, is either the same or is increased. The measurements are fuzzy, but they don't indicate any reduction.
Now, what we know about this cocaine trade is that it has fueled the dirty war.
Right.
How is President Uribe being linked to the paramilitaries, which formed in the 1980s to fight the guerrillas?
Well, President Uribe is a figure of Colombia's far right, and he also comes from the area around Medellin, which has been a stronghold of drug traffickers since the early 80s, really since the years of Pablo Escobar. He was mayor of Medellin in the 1980s when Pablo Escobar was, in fact, the most powerful person in the city. So it goes back pretty far. People on Colombia's right, especially in that part of the country, landowners, people who own mines and extractive industries, drug lords, in the 1980s developed a strategy to respond to the guerrillas who were harassing them, of just arming civilian militias and setting them loose. And if they massacred populations, if they took over towns and forced everybody in the town to leave, committing massive human rights abuses, that was fine with them. These militias came to be known as paramilitaries because they worked hand in glove with the Colombian military. Now, when President Uribe was governor, after being mayor of Medellin a few years later, he became governor of the province where Medellin is. That was in the mid-1990s, that province called Antioquia saw an explosion in paramilitary activity, daily massacres, even more than daily. It became very, very hard to be a human rights activist or a union leader in much of Antioquia when he was governor.
If, Adam, he is both the mayor of Medellin at that time and later the governor of the province, can we deduce here that there is a policy of going along to get along?
Being very pragmatic, well, Uribe is a brilliant politician, and he knows where the power centers of his country are. Well, let's put it that way. I mean, there is no smoking gun evidence that he himself ever had anything to do with the Medellin cartel. There's no recordings or documents or anything showing that he was ever even in the same room as the country's main paramilitary leaders. But there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's a lot of sort of one degree of separation sort of things.
And now we have one member of his administration accused of giving paramilitary leaders a list of trade unionists who are under government protection. What's the controversy there? One can guess what it is.
This is huge. It's a guy who was Uribe's campaign manager in 2002 in a part of the northern coast. He became the head of the Presidential Intelligence Service. From that position, he consulted, he's widely accused of consulting regularly with top paramilitary leaders and some drug traffickers. And part of that was giving them death lists, saying these are union leaders, human rights defenders, opposition politicians who we think should be killed. And a lot of those people that appeared on those lists were indeed killed during Uribe's first term. There's been a growing scandal of some of Uribe's political allies beyond this guy being tied to paramilitarism. They're calling it the parapolitics scandal in Colombia, and it really smells bad up here in Washington.
Why are union members so vulnerable in Colombia?
Well, if you're a union leader, first of all, you've got a country where the wealthy do control it's one of the least equal countries in the world. The wealthy do control a lot of the economy. They tend to be a right-wing bunch. They have devised this strategy of forming paramilitary groups to protect what they have. And the paramilitary groups are there to take out leftists, which, you know, are defined as guerrillas, but the definition gets very fuzzy. Labor leaders tend to be left-wing. They tend to be active in socialist politics, whether they're taking up arms or not. They get classified by these right-wing people with all the money as guerrillas. The paramilitaries then target them, and the result has been in some years, more than 100 labor leaders killed every year. It's down to about 60 or 70, which is still by far the worst in the world. Colombia has been a country where it's been impossible to have a left-of-center political party ever succeed, where being a human rights defender is to have a target on your back, where being a journalist who reports on uncomfortable things is a very dangerous profession, and labor leaders would fit in those same categories.
Mm. We've talked about Colombia being an emerging market with huge crops, oil, flowers, coffee, cocaine, and even, as it turns out, kidnap victims. Mm-hmm. What, 3,100 people are being held hostage, we're told, in Colombia. Tell us about the economy of kidnapping.
Yeah, that's the best estimate. Kidnapping was sort of pioneered by guerrilla groups in the 1980s, early 1990s, as a way of raising money, and it really took a leap after the Soviet bloc fell apart and there was no money coming from anywhere overseas. And it was most of it is for ransom, you know, having done research into your finances to begin with to know how much you can pay. So that has been a key way that the FARC and ELN, leftist guerrillas, have raised money. The FARC have also, starting about 7 or 8 years ago, begun kidnapping well-known Colombians, local politicians and others, and holding them for a long time, not for ransom, but to pressure for a release of their prisoners from Colombian jails. And so there are many of these politicians and some military officers and 3 U.S. citizens, in fact, who are working on a Defense Department contract who've been just festering in the jungle for 5 to 10 years.
We're talking with Adam Isaacson of the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. He'll be back with us in a moment. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now. And we're back with Adam Isaacson, Colombia expert at the Center for International Policy in D.C. He's been telling us about Colombian President Álvaro Uribe, who is lobbying for U.S. aid and free trade in Washington today. But Uribe is being hampered by the flourishing Colombian cocaine trade and links to right-wing paramilitary death squads. In response, Uribe is expected in the coming days to launch an international awareness campaign about how leftist guerrillas known as the FARC treat hostages they've held for years. The poster boy, Emmanuel, a baby conceived and born in the jungle to a prominent hostage. Adam, tell us that story.
Yeah, in 2002, there was a presidential candidate, a senator named Ingrid Betancourt, who is half French, so the French people have made her a cause célèbre. She and her campaign manager, just as a peace process or peace talks with the FARC were ending, went to FARC territory and were immediately picked up and disappeared from view and were held among the other 55 or so hostages that the FARC had been holding. Her campaign manager's name is Clara Rojas, and we have found over the last year that apparently sometime about 3 years ago, Clara Rojas had a baby by an unidentified father, a gorilla, and named him Emmanuel. This, of course, this idea of a baby being born in the deepest part of the jungle under armed guard of gorillas in some encampment, being, you know, it's shocked and moved much of Colombia. Mrs. Rojas's mother the other day published on the internet a letter to the son she's never met, which is an incredibly moving document. So it's really brought, you know, this issue of these hostages who are off in the jungle. You don't hear much new about them. You don't get proof of life videos very regularly. So Colombians, this new reminder has been one of the more moving and immediate ones.
Some of the details strain credulity. Are they true?
I think they are true. The fact that these people are being chained,
chained
at night.
Chained, according to the story, the vice presidential candidate, the mother, is chained to trees by chains around her neck.
That is right, and they even have to sleep that way. Look, we've had testimony from hostages who've escaped and some who've gained their freedom by ransom. At night, in some encampments, they have to sleep in tents that are booby-trapped by remote control. So if there is ever a sense that the military are coming to try to rescue them, as soon as they hear those helicopter blades, somebody hits the button and blows up the tent. This is pretty extreme.
Talk about extremity. The mother, is the evidence there that the mother was raped?
The sense is that no. A Colombian journalist first broke the story about 2 years ago. An escaped hostage about 3 weeks ago gave more information. The feeling is that probably not, but we're not sure.
A Colombian journalist, Jorge Enrique Botero, has said that the story of this boy reflects the degradation of the conflict. He says this is about people who are forgotten by our society. Does it reflect the degradation of the conflict?
Well, it does, although I don't know if there's been a progress. I don't know if there was ever a golden age of Colombia's conflict where people were fighting nobly according to the rules of law for a higher cause. I mean, Colombia's conflict has always been about, and Colombia had a civil war 100 years ago that killed 100,000 people. They had another one 50 years ago that killed 300,000 people, both cases, most of them civilians. So here we are again with another civil war that's killing about 3,000 people, mostly civilians, every year. A lot of this is just people among the poorest level of Colombia society, the wretched of the earth, trying to get ahead, trying to gain control over narco-trafficking routes, trying to win local power, and also really acting out on a real hatred of the small elite that runs the country. There is no rule of law in Colombia. The best estimates are that 96% of the country's murders go unsolved. In the cities, a lot of the larger cities are enclaves where you have something approaching the rule of law, where you are worried about getting a speeding ticket and you can't just get away with crimes. But in much of the country, this is a country the size of Texas and California put together, there really isn't. It's local power that matters, and that often overlaps heavily with wealth.
That in contrast with the elegant restaurants and the luxurious neighborhoods of Bogota.
Yeah, Bogota, Medellin, not counting the slums that surround those cities, those towns are bubbles. You can actually live there and pretend you're not in a country at war. And actually, life has gotten much better in the middle class and wealthy parts of Colombia.
So Uribe is clearly under pressure from the Europeans. Is he under pressure in Washington?
He's under pressure in Washington about this paramilitary politics scandal. People are worried that, you know, there's worry when you're giving $700 million a year to a government and key members of that government are in league with the people sending cocaine here and killing civilians left and right. So he's got a lot to answer for about the allegations of paramilitary linkages. He also just has a lot to answer for about the fact that Colombia has been unable to punish things like union leader killings. About 99% of those have gone unpunished. Mm-hmm. And that worries people here who, you know, A, are looking at the renewal of an aid package, and B, are under a lot of pressure to in Congress to approve a free trade agreement that the Bush administration and the Uribe government signed last November. So this trade agreement is moving, and most of the Democratic leadership in the Congress is unenthusiastic about it, largely because, you know, a lot of Democrats have a labor base, and this is the country that's the most dangerous in the world to be a labor union leader.
Aid and trade, free
that's
trade,
right.
Will they improve conditions in Colombia?
I think that aid can. Free trade, if it's, you know, in the current agreement has some problems because it could create a real shock to rural Colombia. Sort of like, remember what happened to corn growers in Mexico NAFTA. But if small farmers are thrown out of business in Colombia, what are they going to do? They're going to grow coca. And aid could be more useful. Right now our aid is 80% military, and it's aimed really at just eradicating crops with not enough to actually help Colombia really govern these rural areas where the coca is grown and where the conflict is the worst. We need to be investing more in the judicial system. We need to be helping just do basic things like build roads and give people clean water and make them actually believe that their government can help them and not turn to the guerrillas, and a lot more for the judicial system so they can take apart this incredible power that paramilitaries and narco-traffickers have over key parts of the state in Colombia to help them clean house.
Thanks for joining us, Adam. Adam Isaacson runs the Colombia program at the foreign policy think tank, the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a mega skyscraper's going up in Dubai. South Korea's reaching for the ozone layer, too. What's causing this building boom? The desire to make money or the need to flaunt it? That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More than a dozen people have been killed today in bombings across Iraq. One blast happened during lunchtime at a restaurant in Baghdad's Shiite stronghold of Sadr City. Earlier, a suicide bomber in Ramadi struck a police checkpoint. Just an hour before that, a suicide bomber blew up his truck at a police station near the Syrian border. Mortar attacks in two different areas in Baghdad as well. In other words, what's become a normal day in Iraq. The death toll for the U.S. military is approaching 3,500, with 22 dead in just the first 6 days of June, putting this month on a pace to equal May's, which was the deadliest month of the year so far for American troops. The drone of violence comes as Congress holds hearings in Washington on President Bush's nominee to be his next war czar. Lieutenant General Douglas Lute is appearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Where are we today? Not where any of us would like. Especially in Iraq, progress has been too little and too slow. No one is satisfied with the status quo. Not the Iraqis, not the key regional partners, not the U.S. government, and not the American people.
Josh Rogan covers defense and foreign policy for Congressional Quarterly, and is at the hearing today. He joins us now. And Josh, what's jumped at you out at you so far in this hearing?
Well, David, first of all, a lot of the confusion surrounding this position created a lot of the controversy. So today we found out a lot about what this job would actually be. So primarily, according to Lute, his role will be to represent the military in Washington, D.C. In other words, provide a direct line for Petraeus and other leaders to have their immediate concerns on the ground addressed by policymakers. Go ahead.
Let me ask you this. Before you tell us more about the job, tell us about him. What's his background?
Well, everyone agrees that General Lute is a qualified, experienced military officer. Since September, he's been Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Before that, he was Director of Operations for Central Command, where he oversaw large parts of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. So the man knows Iraq, and he's got a lot of confidence coming out of Congress.
And yet, General Lute acknowledged today being skeptical of the president's decision to send thousands more troops into Baghdad. The committee chair, Democratic Senator Carl Levin, pressed him on that. Let's listen in.
Were the reasons for your skepticism you believe justified by the events that have occurred?
Senator, I'd reply by saying I think the bidding is still out. We have taken steps on other dimensions inside the U.S. government, and the Iraqi government has taken some steps to demonstrate that it understands that it must surge, if you will, alongside of us. The Iraqi participation in the surge has been uneven so far. And I think we're in the early days, and time will tell.
It sounds, Josh, like he's still skeptical. How did the other senators react to this?
Well, Democratic senators thought to press him on this regarding comments that he made before he was nominated to the position. Lute handled it by saying that while he was involved in policy development, he expressed those concerns and that they were heard. On the other hand, he also said at another point in the hearing that he doesn't believe the Iraqi government has the capability to play its part in the surge, which Democrats seized upon to point out that why are we sacrificing so many lives in Iraq for a surge effort to provide breathing room for a government that can't fit the bill.
And, Josh, some senators, I understand, express strong concerns about what this appointment says about the kind of war advice the president's getting from, among others, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. Here's Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed.
My sense is, if you step back, your appointment represents a devastating critique of the national security apparatus of this White House, because all you're being asked to do was what Mr. Hadley and Dr. Rice were supposed to be doing for the last several years: identify problems, coordinate resources, bring them to the attention of the president, get presidential direction, and that has been abysmal.
In fact, Senator Reid, a Democrat, said Hadley should be fired. Tell us about that, Josh.
Well, that's right, and this highlights a central criticism of the Democrats regarding this position, that it's simply redundant and unnecessary, that Secretary Gates, General Pace, that it's their job, as well as Mr. Hadley, to advise the president and to provide this role. Lute responded that all these officials have a wide range of responsibilities, and therefore he would be singularly focused on Iraq and Afghanistan, but he did admit that Stephen Hadley would not have Iraq and Afghanistan in his portfolio, something that John Warner of Virginia bristled at and sought to reverse somewhat unsuccessfully.
Singularly focused, but is he going to have any clout?
Well, clout's an interesting issue because the way the role is defined, he doesn't have any decision-making power. He's a small staff of 10 to 12 people, and his role is to advise the president, who will make the decisions, and then to implement the strategy downwards by corralling non-military parts of the government to stay engaged and get involved. People have criticized the fact that he's only a three-star general, and will he have the ability to contend with cabinet secretaries? But it doesn't seem that his rank is really the issue. The issue is whether or not he could really affect a policy change if his views differed from the president.
Yes, but that rank is important to this extent, it would seem to me. They went through the ranks of the five stars, they went through the ranks of the four stars, and they had to settle for a three-star general to run this. Does that say something about the military's confidence in this war?
Well, David, it's no secret that there are a lot of senior military officials who have issues with the way that this administration has handled the prosecution of the war. The fact that they went through a few different people was sort of blown up in the press because it was leaked and it was mishandled, and the clarity of the position wasn't established at an early point. But I think at this point, senators, at least, especially on the Democratic side, don't seem to be concerned about that because they all have confidence in Lute as an individual.
But they said this was an impossible job, did they not?
Yes, and that's the key point, is will anybody, not just a three-star general, be able to get civilian agencies back to be involved in Iraq, and can anybody, regardless of their rank, convince the president to make a change in course?
Now, one interesting thing said today by General Lute was that he didn't think the Americans were in a position or should press the Iraqis too hard. That had to have been disconcerting to Democrats.
But again, this goes to the point of what are we pushing? If we push them to do things that they can't do, what does that really achieve? So he is on board with the strategy as of today. What he's saying is that we need to balance the surge against other efforts in the region and political, and to make sure that it's a comprehensive effort and not just a surge with no follow-up.
Mm. Finally, Josh Rogan, whenever we talk about Iraq, we have to talk about politics.
Sure.
Today's would have seemed to have been an opportunity for Democrats opposed to the war to have made a big stand. Did
sure.
they make that stand today?
No, and there's an interesting reason why. Senator Levin has said on many occasions that he plans to use the upcoming defense authorization bill as his next platform to introduce withdrawal language for Iraq. Again, they don't. Senator Levin told me yesterday that he doesn't feel that General Lute will be able to change the president's policy, so he doesn't really feel that it's a really useful exercise to try to convince him to do something that he won't be able to do.
We'll see if September has much meaning when September comes, I guess.
Well, yeah, there are two key dates here. One is a July 15th reporting date by the president that Warner constantly brings up, and the other is the September date when Petraeus will report and a lot of different political forces will coalesce.
Josh, we have to run. Josh Rogan covers defense and foreign policy for Congressional Quarterly. He's covering today's confirmation hearing on Lieutenant General Douglas Lute to be President Bush's war advisor. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Later in the show, a father, a son, and the good, the bad, and the ugly of high school baseball. You're listening to Here and Now. There's much joy in Anaheim today and probably further proof of global warming. In the land of hockey, the mighty, mighty Ducks have proved supreme, capturing Lord Stanley's Cup, beating the Ottawa Senators 4-1. And now that hockey has wrapped up its season, sports fans can turn to the NBA, which begins its finals tonight as the upstart Cavaliers with their phenom LeBron James take on Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, and the formidable San Antonio Spurs. Joining us to talk hockey, basketball, and the rest of the world of sports is our favorite man, the former upstart, the current phenom on the floor, court, ice, classroom, baseball diamond, and in the air. Only a game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, nice to see you again.
It's nice to be back, and I may be the oldest person ever to be called a phenom, which is a distinction of sorts, so thank you.
And Bill, this is the first NHL championship for the Ducks and for the state of California. How hot does that make it?
Well, it's the first for the Ducks and for California. Of course, Tampa Bay has won one. Carolina has won one. The Stanley Cup is perfectly comfortable in the Sun Belt by now, I assume. It is interesting to me that this is the first Stanley Cup championship ever won by a team which took its name from a fictional team made up of children. And I think that's kind of an interesting distinction.
And someone raises the question of whether they got higher ratings than the Food Channel.
It's going to be neck and neck, unfortunately. I did manage to see a little bit of the game. I was kind of going through the channels last night. And maybe the most important thing is that it was hardly a squeaker. Six goals. To let in six goals in the final pretty well indicates that you don't really deserve the Stanley Cup, and that was the situation Ottawa found itself in last night.
A pretty decisive final. Moving on to basketball. Tonight, a lot of attention will be on LeBron James as his red-hot Cavaliers will face the San Antonio Spurs in San Antonio. LeBron is known for his unselfish play for passing the ball to open teammates rather than taking over the game himself. But is he enough to make his team a contender?
Almost certainly not. San Antonio will probably be able to do what Detroit could not do, and that is gang up on LeBron James to the extent that Cleveland is basically disarmed. And I think that's much more likely. Almost always, a team coming to the finals for the first time finds itself overmatched in that situation. And a lot of people have been talking about LeBron James as the Michael Jordan reincarnation that the NBA has been waiting for so long. If you look at Michael Jordan's circumstances, the Chicago Bulls weren't really good enough to win a championship until Michael Jordan had an adequate supporting cast. And LeBron James doesn't quite have that at this point.
Moving on, tennis and the French Open. And for fans of the women's game, we're not going to give anything away about today's semifinals.
Yeah, people are taping this. They don't. They've got their hands over their heads. They're going, "Oh, la, 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 can't hear you."
And we're not telling. But tomorrow, the men play. Rafael Nadal of Spain will meet Novak Djokovic of Serbia. We're taking a trip into foreign affairs here. Number one ranked Roger Federer of Switzerland meets Nikolai Davidenko. Though Federer is ranked number one, he has yet to win the French Open. He lost to Nadal in the final last year. Bill, do you think you can pronounce those names quickly? And do you think they're going to meet again in the finals this weekend?
Yeah, I think the only names that we need to worry about are Federer and Nadal. They are very thoroughly favored in these semifinal matchups. Nadal, of course, has won the French Open twice already, even though he's only 21 years old. He has an incredible streak on clay and at the French Open, and Federer has been exceptionally consistent in terms of semifinals and finals that he's reached on his current streak. I think we can hope that the finals will be a great match, and I guess if I had to pick a winner, it would be Nadal again, because he doesn't seem to be at all vulnerable on this surface.
To be invulnerable at 21.
Oh, man, what a feeling it must be, huh?
And finally, Bill, surprisingly, we haven't talked baseball yet. You have a baseball story for us coming up after the break.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to talk to Dan Shaughnessy, who Boston readers and New England readers know as a longtime Boston Globe columnist. He's got a book out called Senior Year about his son's senior year playing high school baseball, and he takes the opportunity to talk about his own baseball experience as a kid as well. So it's a kind of a father-son book, and I'm looking forward to talking to him about that.
Okay, Bill. We'll look forward to that. Bill Littlefield covers sports and a whole lot more every weekend on Only a Game. Don't miss it. Bill, still a phenom well after 21. Thanks for joining us.
An exceptional distinction. Thank you.
It's Here and Now. I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now. Boston Globe sports writer Dan Shaughnessy has long chronicled the ups and downs of the Red Sox. Now in a new book, he tackles the story of an amateur slugger, a talented high school senior applying to college, and, oh, who happens to be his son, Sam. Dan follows Sam through the last year at Newton North High School. Along the way, he muses on how baseball has been a constant in the Shaughnessy family. The memoir is called Senior Year, A Father, A Son, and High School Baseball. Bill Littlefield, the host for Only a Game, spoke to Shaughnessy about his book. As Dan told Bill, he set out to capture an experience that he had great affection for.
I knew I was going to miss it. I really liked driving around to Norwood and Walpole and even Braintree and having all the teammates at the house for the sleepovers and the cookouts and the team dinners. Sports has always been, to me, a connector of generations, and I think the high school experience can really do that.
There is a moment, though, that you chronicle very early in the book where you're standing in the parking lot and sort of hoping you can see your kid hit once more because there's somewhere else you really have to be.
I was out in what they call the third lot at Newton North High School, and I knew I needed to get to a wake. My cousin Mickey, his son, had died of OxyContin. So, yeah, I'm out there in the parking lot, and I know the wake's wrapping up in an hour. It's out where I was born and grew up. I had this push-pull tug going on. I wanted to see the game. It was the bottom of the 10th, and dusk was coming in. I knew it wouldn't last much longer. Long and short of it is, you know, Sam hits a home run, a walk-off, and hits his own car, which in itself is a story, Bill, because I think our fathers would have been mad at the dent in the car, whereas we now see it as like a badge of honor. Isn't this cute? Anyway, that moment, that powerful moment of the joy and the sadness kind of inspired me to just write things down, which is what I did over the next 12 months.
The home run that you mention with which Sam dented his car was not the only one that he hit. He hit a lot of home runs. Would you have written this book, do you think, if Sam hadn't been such a good hitter?
I would say probably yes. It just was convenient that he had some success as a high school hitter, and it gave the book a few elements of recruiting. And a lot of times, it's not good to be one of the better kids around because you're a target and you think you're overrated, and chances for failure are so much more because there's more pressure. And there's way too much pressure on our kids here to get into colleges, pressure they put on themselves and that they get from their parents. And the high school sports experience can be part of that.
You write that you arranged your work schedule so that you could be present at all the Newton North High School games during Sam's senior year. You traveled like a madman for months before the baseball season began, but you also warn your readers about becoming parents who get too involved in the athletic careers of their children. Where would you draw the line that separates enthusiastic about from too involved in?
That's a very good question. I mean, you can't on one hand say, you know, don't get too involved and write a book about your son's last year of high school, so that's a little bit of a conflict inherent there. My feeling is there's a code of conduct. It's okay to be there. I can't imagine not wanting to be there. At the same time, I'm far away. I have a hat pulled down over my eyes. I'm not vocal. I never comment on other people's children. I think unless you have something positive to say, they don't need you standing yelling, come on, Johnny, get a hit. They know they're supposed to get a hit. My dad would sit in his car out in right field and hit the horn if something good happened.
I don't know if Sam Shaughnessy is good enough to play beyond college.
No, I doubt that.
At a couple of points in senior year, you speculate about the particular pressures that he would face in pro ball, being the son of a guy who's been known to slam ball players in his column. Does that possibility of payback worry you?
Oh, I don't think so. He's not going to get to that level. But the idea that, you know, if Curt Schilling, for instance, were to have a chance, you know, it might not be the most comfortable thing. Sam might have to be announced with an anonymous name since Curt is not a fan of mine. But that's not going to be an issue. I think that he probably has a chance to be more of a target. And with the whole websites and internet, kids can be mean to each other, so that's a possibility. But you know what? He's had advantages. Like anybody, those things, it comes with certain bad parts, and being a little bit more of a target is a deal. But he's 18, 19 years old now. He's big enough to handle that stuff.
Incredible advantages. You'd get down to spring training and bring back cast-off bats for your son to go through to see if he could find a good one.
The clubhouse guys were good to me. And whenever players would leave the Red Sox, they leave bats behind. It's inevitable. So, yes, the cast-off would, Edgar Renteria or John Olerudo, guys that wouldn't come back would leave bats behind. And Sam got to pick out some major league wood because the minor league players like to come in and get that stuff too. But I was friends with the clubhouse guys.
In senior year, and in lots of columns, you have written about the way the game of baseball should be played. And ironically, there were times when your son, Sam, couldn't play it according to the standards that you have talked about. Were you surprised when he threw his bat, argued with the umpire, argued
mortified.
With the coach?
Absolutely. You know, I saw him styling with a home run when he was 11 years old, you know, and just the things that they learned from SportsCenter and the wrong lessons, you know, style over substance. It's always a temptation for kids, but there's more of it now because of what we call the ESPN effect, and we glorify and replay a lot of these things. And, you know, not being a good teammate, not being a good captain, being selfish, hanging your head, those are common high school maladies. You know, it's not fun when it's your own child and they're not holding up their end to the rules that I assign to players on an everyday basis. If I see a big leaguer doing that, I'd be hooting on him in my column.
You write that if you had done some of the things that Sam did, your father, out in the car getting ready to hit the horn if something good happened, would have pulled you off the field and said, "Too late, Danny, I don't think we need baseball for you anymore." Why didn't that happen with Sam?
Well, it was too important to him, and part of that is why some of the bad behavior came out, which, and you know, my wife and I would talk about it. At some point, you have to look at the large picture, which is, okay, let's be thankful these days, you know, if they're not arrested, they're not dealing drugs, you know, there's not some calamity, some horrible getting thrown out of school kind of thing. So, okay, you lose your captaincy for a few days. That probably would have been enough for my old man, just the disgrace of that. In our case, it's very important to him. Here's your chance to earn your way back to it. And it's the whole, there's not a lot of tough love these days. Anybody who's out there with kids, much harder for us for some reason to do this than it was for our parents. They had no problem with tough love with us. Let's face it. See you later. But I know that we definitely cut a lot of slack, and that's one of the things the book does is talk about things that happen now versus things that happened then and how parents generically are treated way differently.
There is a lot of personal material in senior
yes.
year, and a lot of it has nothing to do with baseball. For example, you write about Sam's traffic accidents. You write about a night that he came home drunk. How do your wife and kids feel about all the personal stuff in the book?
Nothing went out that wasn't vetted by the family. I mean, everybody in the family had a chance to read this. It was interesting. Sam read it one night. He knew it was going on. I didn't really talk about it with other people. And he is a vehicle through which I can tell high school stories. That's the way I look at it. It's not really a book about him. It's a way to tell high school stories, the universal experience of being a parent and a kid that age. But I wasn't going to do anything that would embarrass him. And I found that they don't embarrass the way we do. You'll see all the stuff he leaves in, and it's amazing. I certainly would not have left that in, but he and his sisters and his mom okayed everything that's in there.
Toward the end of the book, you quote Sam. He's writing some things. You've got his writing portfolio from senior year in high
school. We don't want to send that off to Boston College.
Well, that's it, exactly. You quote him, and he has written, "I hate to read. I have managed not to read more than about 20 pages of any book in high school." Beneath that, you write, "Not something that needed to be forwarded to the good folks at Boston College," but you forwarded it. It's in the book.
They aren't going to read this little thing. It's too late now. He's in there. He's in the Carroll School of Management, so he'll be one of those business guys. And they won't care about it. He's not a Renaissance man, but a good young guy, and we're hopeful for him. And whatever it is, it works for him, and he's getting it done.
But we should probably say, for the record, I think probably neither you nor I recommends reading only 20 pages of every assigned book, unless you can really hit.
Read the books, please. Absolutely. It's just no excuse for that. Read the books, will you?
Dan Shaughnessy writes a sports column for the Boston Globe. The most recent among his many books is Senior Year, A Father, A Son, and High School Baseball. Dan, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Some people want money. Some people want fame. Here's what I'd do if I could do it all night. I'd play baseball in the sun.
Dan Shaughnessy spoke to Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. And this update, Sam has successfully finished his first year at Boston College. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm David Boeri. Please join us again on Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.